Hello everyone, my name is Osman. I'm a doctor working in the East Midlands, and I'm here with some of my colleagues and our esteemed guest. I'd like to introduce Akhil.
Hi everyone, my name is Akhil. I'm a doctor in the West Midlands and I'm also the founder of Mark.
And we're joined today by really an esteemed guest, Professor Asif Ahmed, who is well known as the founder of the Aston Medical School. And he's also the chairman of Mirzaim Therapeutics. We're really, really pleased to have you here. And it's an absolute pleasure to be speaking to you today. So I think what we'll do is we'll have a chat basically about what we're going, what's happening in Mirzaim, about your background. And I think our readers here on Mars the Word would really like to hear your story. So first of all, I have to say, I think all three of us here are King's College London graduates. And I think that's really nice. And I think the other thing is, I think Prof, both of us kind of grew up around North London. So I know you went to Alwood School. I went to Kingsmead in Enfield. So I think that's another nice kind of thing for us to connect over. And I think that's really nice to hear that we're from similar backgrounds. I think the first thing really that our listeners would love to hear about, and something we'd love to hear about, is if you could please tell us how you got involved with maternal health and how you are where you are today.
Thank you, Usman and Akhil. Assalamu alaikum. I wanted, before we do that, because you mentioned about King's College and North London, can I just say that I went to King's College in the 80s, and I think I was one of the one or two or three people of colour in the whole Strand building. And I'm sure today that's a very distinctly different population. So it's something to celebrate that Britain is much more diverse. Although I didn't experience any overt racism, but I'm sure there was. But I think in the current climate, I just wanted to put that in perspective. So it's great to see that you guys have done so extremely well. So going back to what you asked, things like, how did I get involved in maternal health? So it goes back to quite some couple, 20 years ago, probably. And it was, I was working on a problem to do with menstrual disorder, right? Bleeding in pregnancy, and not pregnancy, in gynecological women who had blood loss due to endometrium, which is the lining of the uterus, being defective, right? And that involved a process called angiogenesis, which is formation of new blood vessels. So I was working on this, and you, to do that, you needed to get that tissue, and that was more difficult to get than, say, the placenta is, which is the afterbirth of pregnancy. And one of my colleagues, an obstetrician, said to me, "You work on endometrium. Why don't you look at the placenta? We just throw it away."
Yeah.
And the more I looked into the pregnancy problems, preterm birth, babies being born small, preeclampsia, which is happy to explain that, I just realized that this is a major problem that needs addressing. I got involved on the molecular side of it, from growth factors like VGF kind of thing. So it was a very different approach. But I think it was when my daughter said to me, when we were walking in Malvern Hill, and she said, "Daddy, you work on VEGF, but what have you actually done?" And what she really meant, and she was 10, and I'd been a professor for 8 years by then. This is a long time ago. 2006 or something. And what she really meant, what have I done for others? What have I done for patients? What have I done for society? And the next day, my lab really changed. So I had a student who was struggling with her PhD, working on this receptor, tyrosine kinase receptor. And I said to her, "Look, we've done it for 8 months. Let's bin it. Let's look." So you got to learn to be able to say, "This is not working. I've got to do something else." Not just keep banging your head against the wall.
Definitely.
right? So that was the first lesson, I would say. And then I said, why don't you look at something I did a few years ago, 6-7 years ago, where I was looking for a protective protein, and see if that inhibits the culprit protein of preeclampsia. And so that's how I got involved, if you like, in a much more active way to address the issue of maternal health.
I think our listeners would love to hear your story of how you became a vascular scientist, and coming into that field must have had its own challenges, of course. And as you said, in the 80s, there was only one or two BME student in the whole of King's College, and now it's a completely different look. You have so many societies of so many people from all different cultures, and it's brilliant to see. But for you, as a student, to become a vascular scientist, we would love to hear that story as well.
Well, I think the synthesis happened by meeting Professor Gustav Born.
Mm.
The late Professor Gustav Born, who became my lifelong mentor. And just to put it in perspective, who he was. So everyone who's today taking a mini aspirin,
mm-hmm. yeah,
John Vane wouldn't have got the Nobel Prize for discovering how aspirin works if he wasn't able to use the Born aggregometer,
mm.
right? And so Gus invented the Born aggregometer.
For our listeners, could you maybe explain what this is?
Yeah, so if you think of platelets,
yeah.
they're the smallest cells in the blood.
Yeah.
When you cut yourself, mm-hmm. the platelets come together and they plug the hole.
Yeah.
Now, even till not so long ago, only way doctors could measure bleeding time was to make a cut and measure how long it takes to stop. It wasn't quantifiable.
Yeah.
Because Professor Born was the son of Max Born, the Nobel Prize winner for quantum mechanics, so he grew up in a mathematical and engineering kind of background field. He used the concept of light being opaque when platelets would plug. So he took the plasma, separated the blood, put it into cells, platelet-rich plasma, and by aggregating it, obviously the light will change. So when that changes, that could be recorded, mm-hmm. right, on a recorder. So that's how they could quantify the aggregation of platelets. And so they discovered various molecules that block the aggregation of platelets or stimulate the aggregation of platelets. And then they could find, that's how they found aspirin was preventing that aggregation. So that's how the thing developed. And I made a contribution to that by making a whole blood aggregometer. That's another story, but going back to Born was the head of pharmacology at the time, and I kept hanging out to see him so I could do my project with him, and that led me to various kind of exposure, and that's how I think I would say the idea of local hormones in blood having an effect on vessels got educated about and exposure to.
It sounds like you have had some prominent mentors in growing up. Would you have said that you would have become a scientist if it wasn't for your mentors, or is it something that did you always have a scientific mind?
No, I think everyone's born same, right? Mm. It's exposure and opportunities, mm. right? So my father is a scientist. And so as a child, we would go to, he's an engineering, he's combustion kind of person. And he made some discoveries. The company came out of it later, but on pollution. So inhibiting particulates understanding. So we used to go to his laboratory as a kid, my brother and I. So we were exposed to people, and people who were scientists, who were international researchers, who would come and stay at our house. Mm-hmm. So you got exposed to them, and even students, he would host them for a while till they found a place to stay. So we had a very international upbringing at home. So that exposure was probably a big part. But my father was definitely the driver of pushing us towards science. But I didn't want to do what he did because I didn't want him to know what I'm doing.
Well, it led to some interesting dinner discussions.
Yeah, no, I was just trying to avoid him knowing. I didn't want to do engineering and maths because I knew that then he will want, if I'm doing pharmacology or medicine or something, then he doesn't know enough about it that I can just fake it till I make it.
I think myself and Osman, we did a degree in immunology and infectious diseases. And I think we appreciate, even though it's just a BSc, we can appreciate how difficult the job, like the role is. Like we were in the labs, myself and Osman, and we were doing these projects. And every single time we grew ourselves and we spent so much effort and care and patience growing ourselves. And it was Friday, then you come back on the Monday, and during the weekend, all your cells have died. And then you have to go back to square one, you have to start the project again. And that gave us real PTSD about going back into a lab. So I'm sure we can appreciate, you know, the role that scientists have to do to create these innovations and these mass changes is phenomenal work behind the scenes.
Yeah, I think the key thing is, so controls, right? Mm. And persistence, because most of the time things don't work. Mm. And so if you're a surgeon, you see your result, mm. right? But if you're a physician, you might be treating for a long time chronic disease, but you don't necessarily see a reward as quickly. And if you're a scientist, from your discovery to benefiting patient, it could be 10 years, it could take $2 billion.
Yeah.
Right. So it just depends. But as long as you have there's lots of small things. You know, like yesterday, one of my students got her PhD. Now, yeah. This is a girl who came to UK age 13 with no English as a refugee from Afghanistan. Yeah. And 14 years later, she's getting a PhD, and the external examiner rings me to say, the thesis is brilliant. She's very smart,
yeah.
And she defended it really well. So that's empowerment, right? And she just sent me a card today. Well, she dropped a card and some gifts. And in that she says, because we have a thing, we'll make preeclampsia history within this decade. So she's put on the card, let's make preeclampsia history.
Yeah, that's really nice. So speaking of preeclampsia, maybe if, just for our listeners, if you could define what preeclampsia is, and then we can kind of talk a bit about, you know, the vast amount of research that you've done.
So let's start by saying that every minute we are talking, a life is lost to preeclampsia, mother or a child, right? Mm-hmm. It is a condition in pregnancy to otherwise healthy young women in their reproductive age. It affects, so if you're a woman, halfway through your pregnancy, you get visual disturbance, headaches that won't go away with aspirin or paracetamol. You get swellings in your legs, then you need to go and see your doctor, and he will take a blood pressure and measure if there is protein in your urine, and if blood pressure is high or the protein is high, they'll suspect you got preeclampsia. But there is no clear cut of definition except that there's high blood pressure and one or all things like small for babies are born small or systemic organ damage, etc. Right? Mm. And it affects 1 in 12 of 130 million pregnancies a year. But it's not just preeclampsia. There is also small for gestational age babies born, and they are even more prevalent. So 1 in 6 of that births are of 131 million pregnancies is babies born small for gestational age. which is sometimes called fetal growth restriction. And this group, 25 or 1 in 4 of these kind of babies are born in Southeast Asia, so Asian subcontinent. So I think that's, I would say, would give you hope. And our purpose at Mirzyme and my research is to make preeclampsia history within this decade. So girls like May, who told me, I don't want to get pregnant till we have a cure for preeclampsia, can get married and have a family.
I mean, the numbers are staggering, really, about the number of women who are affected by this condition. And I think, you know, as part of MAR as well, that's something that we're trying to focus on. And I think, you know, it's such a massive, massive undertaking. And I think people perhaps don't understand how much this affects global pregnancies. So, I mean, it is really, really important work. Perhaps if you wouldn't mind, we could talk about, or you could explain kind of a summary of your research so far on preeclampsia.
Sure. So I think the reason it hasn't progressed so fast as other conditions, because people have extrapolated from other diseases to pregnancy to preeclampsia. And I think that's the wrong approach. So just because it's a pregnancy-specific disorder, so we took a very different approach, not on 1 in 12 women who get it. We asked, what do the 11 have that they don't get it? Right? And so we asked, by asking that question, we were able to find the protective pathways. So, but going back, back in 1997, I think, my lab was the first lab to show that that protein that my daughter was talking about, VEGF, it stimulated, it stimulates nitric oxide, this small molecule that dilates blood vessels, right? And I had proposed at the time that maybe the endogenous inhibitor of VEGF, this is called soluble FLT, maybe it goes up in pregnancy and those people get preeclampsia. Now, that was a speculation or hypothesis. And it was at least 3-4 years later, ourselves and another group in the States, but they did a much better experiment. They gave the protein as an adenovirus, actually, to pregnant rats and showed that they got those kind of things. And what we did is we did a very unique kind of experiment where we said, if this is human placenta and produce, if it's preeclamptic, it produces this protein. What if we put that extract onto cells that make blood vessels? Will they make less blood vessels? And that's what we showed. And then we asked the question, okay, that's making less blood vessel, but what happens if we remove that protein from that soup? Will it bring the blood vessels growing to the same levels as the normal placenta, not the preeclamptic? And we did that, and it was true. Response was bigger, and we published it in Circulation Research at the time. But that concept was taken up by another group who then created a trap to trap these proteins, like a renal dialysis type thing. That's okay, and it works. So, you know, if you live in Boston and you've got access to fantastic facilities, then it will work, right? Because it's going to be very limited. It will be used, and it's going to be risky because it's an invasive intervention. So my concept was, I want to create drugs that can be used globally with relative ease and affordable and accessible. So for that's how we came up, and targeted therapeutics so that we can predict who will get preeclampsia and then give them the treatment in that group. And that's how Mirzyme was evolved to do with one test, one pill saves two lives. But I'm happy to tell you more about the biology and how we came to it.
I think what we would love to hear is, now you have the research and you know what can hopefully solve preeclampsia. So you have the research. How do you translate that to an implementation, and what are some of the challenges you faced?
Yeah, that's a good question. So it's realizing that you can't do it in universities, right? First thing, because decisions need to be made. You know, you need a huge amount of investment, and writing grants is one thing. I mean, we've spent probably about £30 million to get to where we are. Mm-hmm. Through equity-free, debt-free government investment, if you like. And that's excluding facilities in universities and all those kind of things. And when I realized that we have this unique opportunity, I persuaded the university to hand over the intellectual property rights to Mirzaim. Mm. And in return, we will give them royalty on sales, right? So that's a different model to many places, and I don't think they'll do that with everybody, but it happened. I was able to get, and that gives me the freedom to operate, right? Unfortunately, universities get involved in companies, and that some of them do okay, but most patents end up in going nowhere, and huge loss to the taxpayer. So we need to change those models. So yeah, so you need to bring it in, and then you need to bring a team. So putting ducks. So it's a bit like what I did for the medical school, how I created the medical school by bringing teams of experts and putting them together and looking. So I'm doing the same thing and bringing investment from financial backers who have come in and invested in Mirzaim, and that's taking us forward. And then you have to dive deep, right? You got to be willing to give up your fancy titles and jobs and salaries and dive into it, because it's got to be an obsession. Just if you asked me 5 years ago, everywhere I went, I talked about the medical school I was creating, right? So with whether it was talking to a politician, or when my son was trying to buy a car, I'm talking to the lady about telling her about social mobility and medicine. And now I'm talking only about preeclampsia and how we will bring the therapeutics to market. So in that respect, I'll just tell you how, right? So the market, so you have to think of it this way. The whole market is 131 million pregnancies, right? Of that, the focused market, if you like, the total for preeclampsia and fetal growth restriction or small for gestational age baby, is about 10 to 11 million women get preeclampsia around the world, and about 19 to 20 million growth restricted babies are born, right? And of that, we have focused on three areas: USA, Europe, and China. And you may ask me why, Al, and that's about 3 million. Those are the big markets. Mm-hmm. So that you have an idea. Then we've done a phase 2 clinical trial, as you probably know, on pravastatin, which is a category X drug. It's not allowed to be given. We were given the permission to do it because we discovered that statins inhibit the culprit protein, and we had a soluble FLT. And so it gave a positive trend. It wasn't powered enough to, but it was it's a shotgun approach. So what we've now done, because of a target therapeutic approach, we've identified a set of markers, biomarkers, right, that can predict with 98% certainty. That's in 100 people, 98 people who will go on to develop preeclampsia. And then we can stop that, because we've also discovered the protective pathways I was telling you about, which puts the brakes on the culprit protein. And then drugs that would suppress that culprit protein, we saw trends, as I said to you. But then we now got proof of concept of our drugs in our tailored therapeutics that actually prevent preeclampsia in a number of in vivo models. And we can measure that our treatment is effective because we see the changes in the biomarker proteins. So this is a unique kind of way of going about it.
That sounds pretty amazing.
Yeah, it's really exciting stuff. That's why I told you I've given up everything to do this, because my wife said to me, founding a medical school that is socially inclusive is a regional contribution. If you do this, it's a global thing.
Definitely.
You'll save thousands and maybe millions of lives. So, and I know we've got it. So it's, and there's no one in the space that is doing what we're doing. We have not only therapeutics, but we have, if you like, companion diagnostic, right? Like, who's doing that? It's only in oncology.
Yeah.
No one's doing it in anywhere else. And then now the beauty is we've actually, so if you think of the vaccine, the Moderna and the Pfizer vaccine, or the AstraZeneca vaccine, what are they using? They're using gene therapy to deliver it, right? We've identified and patented globally microRNAs that suppress that protein and shown using the same approach that they suppress it in our in vivo models.
Mm.
So hopefully we can maybe, what I had thought will take 6 years, could be condensed into 3 years. So I mean that's the kind of discussions happening. But you have to go out, raise money, that first thing, bring a team of people with expertise from wide range, from business to regulatory to science, and they have to buy into that vision, right?
Yeah.
So people like May and Milda who've been helping this journey, and there are people who've been helping pro bono because they buy into it, that they want to see this happen. They want to be part of that history-making opportunity so that we can make preeclampsia history.
I think it's so much easier to buy into it when you're obsessed by it. And I really want to highlight the idea that when you were founding the medical school, you had this obsession, the preeclampsia, you have this obsession. And that's the only way you can really make great change, I believe, is when you have an obsession, you sacrifice everything around you and you just focus on that one point. And honing your ideas and your mindset towards that one point gives you the environment, the platform to connect with so many other great people, attract those like-minded individuals and create the results you are doing.
And not only that, so you involve the people around you. So my son is, as I said to you, F2, but he made some of the, for the deck, some of the graphs, because I had PowerPoint graphs and he said, they don't look, and he has skill. Obviously, clearly he has some special skills that I didn't know that he had, and nothing to do with medicine, right? This is just making like a McKenzie deck. So instead of paying McKenzie, I get it for free. Or maybe he'll just pay up, whatever it costs him to do it. But so you get people involved that's how I've done it even before, even during when we were doing the medical school, I had my daughter come to one of the social mobility events for Pathway to Healthcare, because I wanted to hear from her. She went to a fee-paying school, public school, and there were kids who were coming from really deprived state schools. I wanted to ask her, what is it that her school has that these kids don't? And what was really interesting was she said they're really bright and driven, but they lack one thing, Daddy: confidence.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so I knew that was one of the things we have to change. Right? And I said to her, what is it that your school has given you apart from home? What is it that you got at school? Because, well, she was in a lower sixth form, I think, at that time. Every Friday at 11 a.m., the headmistress calls a group of us to meet with external visitors. They could be the bishop, could be the MP, to have tea.
Mm.
Now, I never did that in my school, right? No one had gone to university.
Definitely, yeah. I think, if you want to go into why the med school.
Yeah, the question is, how did you decide to move from research and academia from a research perspective into medical education? Because those are obviously, they're related, but they are very separate fields.
Yeah, so I would say the other way around. So let me put it this way. I didn't give up research. I made medical education into research.
Okay.
Right. So the question was, a group of CEOs, the people you work for, right? So I had them come in and I said to them, what kind of doctors do they want?
Mm.
So, and it was clear that they wanted doctors with leadership and business acumen.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the first thing. The second thing, why did I do it in the first place, right? Why did I, give up being at one of the leading universities to go to some? But I think my daughter is a big influence, the story I told you about what have you done. And then another colleague of mine said to me, you give a good talk about you want to do this and that, but if you want to do it, go to a small institution where you can make a difference. You know, places like Edinburgh and have been around for 500 years, and they'll be here for another 500 years, and you won't make a dent, whether you're assistant principal or the principal for that matter.
Yeah.
I don't think that's entirely true, but I think principals can make a difference, but assistant principals probably can't. So anyway, that was, and then the family didn't want to move up north. So those are the two things. Right? And then there was a third thing, is that Aston at the time had an outstanding vice chancellor, Baroness Brown Julia King, who's a champion of social mobility, who's a champion of diversity. She is one of a kind. And I'm sure she was also the managing director of Rolls-Royce before, and head of engineering at Imperial, right, before she came to Aston. So, but being a woman, probably a little bit older than me, and she would have experienced a lot of discrimination in boardrooms, right? And so she understood that, and she was a tenacious, and she said to me something very simple. She said, all right, come in. If you make it, then you can run it. If you don't, then when our PVC for research retires, then you can do that. So she didn't say, if you don't make it, you're at me. So it was a very different kind of, I learned so much from her. I could talk for hours about inclusivity. I learned from her. Diversity, I learned from her. Because I came from one of the leading universities, and in those universities, you just assume that you're where you are is because of your abilities, but the reality is you're not on the top seat, right? You're not sitting, when I was in the, how many vice chancellors, there is changing now, how many vice chancellors are of people of color, right? So I would say the leadership must look like this, the university should look like the city, right? How many universities look like that?
I agree with that, yeah, definitely.
So this is, and I'm not saying if you're in Winchester, you need to be like that, but if you're in Birmingham or Leicester, Leicester does have a vice chancellor who is of color, but that's recent. So that's something to, so going back to your original question, I've diverted, why do medical education? Because kids or young people didn't have the opportunity, I felt, because 80%, as you know, of medical students come from public schools. And I think that's become worse in the last 10, 15 years than it was probably 20, 30 years ago. Right? So because there's no grants and all those kind of reasons could be a factor. So I wanted to, and I feel talent is being lost. And so it's not about doing medicine. Medicine is hard to get in because it's supply and demand. And it's just become harder now, post-COVID, because 25% more people have applied to do medicine. So it's going to be even harder for people to get in. But so if we want more talent and more resilient, then we need to go and look, make sure we give everybody an opportunity. And that's how so Julia was really supportive. And we had a lot of challenges. I mean, people didn't want another medical school in Birmingham.
Yeah. So I think that leads on quite nicely, to be honest, because setting up a medical school is not a small feat. And I know you mentioned kind of it's kind of in your rearview mirror at the moment, but if you could talk to us kind of about the challenges of setting up an entire institution, because that's really what it is, and an institution which has the potential to impact so many. What would you say maybe the two or three major challenges that you had were?
Yeah, the first is, I think, first of all, it's not you who do it, right? You have a drive and people will come and join you. I mean, it's like what I said to earlier about, not today, but my 5 P's of life. And I'm happy to tell you about that as well. But it's getting, first you've got to get a champion, right? It's like Julia King was the champion. You have an idea. So it wasn't like the university was planning to do it. I came along and said, I want to do this. And she said, okay, have a go. And let's do friends gathering. That was the first thing. Then you have to get group of people who agree. Then you have to get it approved by the university executive and council. So that's an internal thing. And then you need to gather friends from outside. And then you need to win doctors and other professionals, right? Because the challenge was, one, what you said, you know, many of the hospitals at the time said, oh, we don't want to associate ourselves with it's most likely not going to succeed, and therefore we will be seen as failures, right? So no one wants, now everyone wants to join in. At the beginning, no one wants to join in, right? So that's another. So you've got to win friends. And how do you do that? You've got to have a clear narrative. So mine was local doctors, local community at low cost to the public purse. To which David Willetts, who was the minister for universities, who I met with, he said, what is there not to like? And that was an important impact, because then all of his people around him, you know, all the barriers comes down, because he says local doctors, local community, low cost. But then when you say that, the people who are charging high cost, they think, oh, if he brings this disruptive innovation.
Yeah.
And if it's going to be about social mobility, remember 6-7 years ago, no one was talking about social mobility the way we're talking about now, right? So every university is talking about social mobility in medicine. That wasn't even on the agenda of medical school council.
Definitely.
Yeah. Right? Or James, so we pushed, but we did it through getting the government on board, right? So I have to give credit here to, it was David Willett, David Cameron's government at the time that we were engaging with, but obviously the documents and everything, and Health Education England, Ian Cummings was the chief executive, and he bought into it, because there was a lot of rumors going on, we're creating a private medical school for the rich kids, but that wasn't the point. The point was we were going to get 80% of international students, because there were students who had capacity, ability, but who weren't allowed to come here because we had a cap of 7.5%. So I thought of it, well, these are people we should be getting here, and let's use that money to get not my kids, but kids whose parents haven't got the background in medicine or haven't got the financials to, so they can't go to Liverpool from Birmingham or so. So let's get kids locally so they can create local doctors. And the driver was infant mortality for me, to be honest, because, you know, there is a study which showed that in Indonesia or Thailand, I'm not sure, not Indonesia, Philippines, that's right. It was a long time ago I did this. Philippines, they showed a study where infant mortality was like almost 50% in that region, which was the national. And after 14 years, the national infant mortality dropped to 25%. And that region where then they had put a medical school in that period, it dropped to literally less than 10%. Because when you put doctors, trained doctors who go into their own communities, then the people in the community are more receptive. And they see, look, in America, maternal death and preeclampsia and all this is very high in Afro-Caribbean population. Why? It's not because genetics, it's because they're not given the attention that they deserve. But if there were more doctors of color in those hospitals, then they will see it and they will be able to respond. And that's happening, this change. Because I had a friend in Yale, and she said to me, she's a psychiatrist, when my white coat does not protect me when I'm on the street. It was really shocking. You know, we're talking about celebrating health professionals, but she said, my white coat does not protect me when I'm walking on the street. My father, being a leading physician, doesn't protect him when he's driving on the road. And that's another challenge that we need to address. Anyway, but I've diverted.
I think we know the answer to this, but what would you say your vision is for the next 10 years? Like, where do you want to use? Do you want to see yourself and Mirzam going in the next 10 years?
Well, so that's a very easy answer to you. Yeah. So we will make preeclampsia history within this decade. So more families can experience the joy of pregnancy and birth. That is not my vision only. That's the vision of the company. That's the vision of everyone who's involved in it. Like I said to you, May just gave me this card, said, let's make preeclampsia history. And my wife said, she's the one who came up with the phrase, make preeclampsia history, which means, I was thinking, I don't want to, it's not about me making. She said, no, it's a play, it's a double thing. You're going to make it history, and it will be history as well. So it's impactful. So yeah, to make an impact on society and not to worry about me. I'm not worried about me. I mean, yes. And if you do that, my investors will get 15 to 20 times uplift in their investment, right?
Yeah.
And we've done the maths is billions. So yeah. So, and then that allows Mirzam to contribute to the society.
Definitely. I think if we can see with the COVID vaccination is how quickly the world has responded and taking the vaccination up, I think creating awareness about preeclampsia, we can hope to have the same uptake with your medication that you've proposed, and which will help, as you said, millions of lives. In this conversation alone, I wish I knew how many mothers have passed away from preeclampsia and will continue to pass away from preeclampsia. But your work,
I can tell you, every minute, a life, while we've been talking, a life has been lost to a mother or a baby around the world. Every minute. So 76,000 mothers are lost every year, and 500 babies. So if you total that up and you divide it by the number of minutes, you work it out. It's about a minute.
Honestly, so upsetting to hear those figures, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I even worked out... once I went to, someone told me, why are you going to Cairo? It's very dangerous. And I was going to give a talk there and I worked out the 5 hours it took me to fly back from there, how many people had died from preeclampsia. So it's, yeah. And every one in 15 pregnancies ending the disaster and death. And I tell people who, your audience are listening. If I said hands up everyone who's an outcome of pregnancy, that's all of us, right? And then you have to ask, then I tell you that you and I are lucky, and so are our mothers. because they've survived. Because one in 15 of them would have either died or the babies died.
I mean, like I said, they are staggering numbers, and it only highlights how important this work is. And I kind of wanted to just quickly mention, you said earlier, this kind of work, you know, it's important research work in the universities, but in order to get things done, actually, you need to move into the kind of entrepreneurial field for global health, especially. I mean, this is a global health podcast, you know, that's what we're trying to focus on. What would you say the role of entrepreneurship, and I know Aster Medical School has like a, like you mentioned, a mini MBA type. What would you say entrepreneurship and leadership makes a difference to in global health?
Yeah. So I don't think it's about degrees, right? I mean, the reason we gave a mini MBA type thing, a certificate of master's type thing in the medical school curriculum is to give people some example of leadership and knowing about healthcare. But entrepreneurship is different. Someone said once, it's like jumping out of an aeroplane with the parachute and then trying to put the parachute on while you're falling, and then making sure that you land with the parachute released, right? So I've always been willing to take those risks to move from one. So do something, then move on to do something for a purpose, and make that purpose your passion, and make sure that you work with people you enjoy working with. So that's the way I would say it. What you need is roughly four or five things, right? Timing is everything, right? Why is preeclampsia now more important than it was, say, 10 years ago? I mean, women have been dying all the time, right? Mm. So if you think about that, I would say it's because today women are choosing to have families later in their lives. And I said to you earlier that if you're especially college-educated, professional career women are having their babies in mid-30s. Right?
Yeah.
But if you're mid-30s compared to mid-20s, the risk of preeclampsia goes up 4.5 times.
Okay.
But we have found a cure so that women can have the choice and their family when they have their child, because they don't have to compromise their profession, because that's what they spend time early on to build. So they don't have to feel that guilt. So that's for, and that group of professionally educated women are not just going to be in the United States and Europe. They're growing across the world. And so they're across the world. You know, my wife is a doctor. She got married at 24. My sister got married, I think, 28, 29. And I know many of my students are getting married in their 30s, who are finishing their PhDs. So they're going to have children later in life. And so you need to have that opportunity that you can have that. And so I think we will provide that option. That's one thing. Right? Second thing is that you need, so timing is important. Then you need a team to execute that. Ideas, lots of people have ideas. Ideas enough is not enough. So you need a team that you need to be able to assemble. And if you're in your 20s and 30s, you're less likely to have the network that if you are in your late 40s and 50s and 60s, right? So having done the medical school, I have a business acumen. I know how projects are executed. I know how timelines are. I know who to bring in, when to bring in.
Yeah.
Right? So all of those things play a role. Then you need to have the science and the patent and the pipeline of things to come. And then you need funds, right?
Mm-hmm.
But actually, it's not the most important thing. It does become important. I mean, and you've got to choose the right people who you want, who understand your values. You don't want to bring in somebody who wants to make a quick buck. So, so yes, people who have invested, we will give them 10 to 20 fold uplift. So if someone has put in £1 million, I expect them to get 10 or 20 million pound back 5 years from now. Right. Yeah. And yes, we will become, we're already considered a so-called unicorn, right? $1 billion company on paper. But that doesn't mean anything. The reality is when you make save lives, that will happen anyway.
Yeah.
And then you got to choose the market and you got to have, so we've taken a very global, most people think local, right? That's why you can't do it in the universities. Right. Most people think I'm going to do for England or for Britain. We've gone 3 continents. China is in itself like a continent, right?
Mm.
We've gone for a lot. America is the number one market. Europe, and now that we're outside Europe, we're going to have to think about whether we do the clinical trials in England or in Europe, because EMA is a big of market. But it may work because AstraZeneca just did it, and they did it here, and then got it approved. So it may work in that way. So those are the kind of thing. I think the whole world is changing very fast. So new drugs for unmet medical need will get accelerated, and needs to be.
I think, Prof, you've given a really pragmatic approach from idea to fruition for our listeners. What I love to see is that, you went to King's College. As you mentioned, you were the few who was of, ethnic background in King's College, and you become this very successful vascular scientist. And then you thought, when your nine-year-old daughter asked you the question of what have you done really, you thought about it, and now you've created a change regionally with creating a founding a medical school, and now you're looking at creating change globally for many generations to come. And our listeners will love that. And if you could speak, maybe give some of our budding young students, our young population, some advice, what advice would you give them?
Right. I'll give you, I'm not good at giving advice, but I'll tell you what I have benefited from. So I'd say find and pursue extraordinary mentors that will help you. And ask for help when you need it, right? So that's one thing to do. Second thing I'd say, make your purpose your passion, and make your passion your joy, and work with people you enjoy, right? Not always you can do that, but try to find that balance that gives you. And then involve everyone. It becomes an obsession, but involve your family. I tell everybody, everyone in my family knows what preeclampsia is, right? Because my kids knew what VGF is, and my daughter, even when she was 10, VGF binds to receptor 1 and R2 and stimulates nitric oxide, all of those. So I kept telling them about it. So you tell people what you want to do. Would be the thing, and doesn't matter what you do. So one of your colleagues said to me, "Oh, I wish I'd done medicine." And she's an economist, and I said, "Look, economy, medicine is a service. Economists provide job opportunities and set policies that affects all of us. So it doesn't matter what you do, do it well." And do it with that focus and grit. And so if I had words to give, it would be obsession, resilience, right? And excellence.
Mm.
Those are the 3 things I would say. I'll finish off by telling you my 5 P's, because if that's all right. So my 5 P's of life, the first 2 were given to me by Richard Ernst, who got the Nobel Prize for NMR spectroscopy. Right? Richard said, in our profession, if you're not dreaming of Stockholm, don't do it.
Yeah.
To which I said, Richard, you can say that, you got the Nobel Prize. He got it in 91, I think, and this was 2004. But he said, no, if I said it, it would look crazy. If I said to you, oh, think of Nobel Prize, and you think, he ain't got it, why is he telling me to think about it? Right? So, and he said, no, it's because you need an additional passion. His was painting. I write poetry. I'd just then I had published a book on poetry with a group of poets, and he was asking, you know, will you be writing another set? And I said, no, I don't have time for that. I've got to write grants and all this kind of science stuff. So I can get what you got. anyway, but he said, so that was the two P's, right? Your profession, your additional passion. I'd say that you need three more P's. You need a purpose. Because when you have purpose, work isn't work. It's a joy. The vision pulls you. Then you need persistence. Because everyone, or 99% of the people, will say it can't be done. I've had it all the time. It can't be done. It's a pipe dream. All you have is a pipe dream. I was told about the medical school, but look, it's no longer a pipe dream. Not over my dead body. I've been walking over dead bodies all my life. You know, so you just got to be. But even then, with your persistence and your focus and your resilience, you will hit a brick wall and you can't go through and you can't go around. You don't know what to do. That's when power of persuasion comes in. When you persuade others to join that team, that vision, and it's no longer your vision, it becomes a common vision, and they will help you pull over the wall. So that's my bit about how you go about it. So my advice, people, is get obsessed with whatever you do. Don't give up. You will succeed. And don't let other people put you down.
That's some great piece of advice. Whilst you were saying that, I was actually writing down what you were saying, because I think that's some great piece of advice and it would definitely resonate well with our listeners.
Absolutely. I think we could sit here, to be honest, all day talking. And I think, you know, obviously, you know, it's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you and really, I would say, a great privilege. So thank you once again.
No, it's my privilege. Listen, you guys are doing a fantastic job. You're transmitting the information to the whole community and the world out there, right? So, and you are doctors. This is not your job, day job. So this is your passion, your purpose. And that's, so you're doing what I'm just saying.
Yeah. I mean, I think it would be somewhat of an honor to be following in those kinds of footsteps, and you know, I think you as a kind of a pillar of the community, it's an honor to hear these words from you, to be honest. And I know our listeners also will be delighted to hear everything that we've talked about today.
And I just want to end by telling one thing to all of you young people, including you two. Look, the difference between me and you is not intelligence, is only thing is experience, right? But what you have, I don't have, and I can never have. I cannot buy it if I was a trillionaire, which is time. Time is one commodity you cannot buy back, right? So in a heartbeat, I would switch with you guys to be me, right? So people, when they look at someone, don't look at where they are. Think what the journey has been. So, and it's all a journey.
Yeah.
So it doesn't matter if you're a vice chancellor or now I'm a senior advisor to the president of the University of Southampton. So what? But I'm doing that because I want to make a difference. And I can do that because I'm in a position where I can do that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And you'll be there as well. So just do what you're doing, like you're doing, and inshallah, you know, the stars will rise. And remember, if you aim for the stars, if you fall, you land on the moon. But if you aim for the moon, you'll fall back to earth.
What a great way to end it. I love that.
I think we'll call it a day there. I mean, thank you for joining us on Mars the World, the Global Health Podcast, and hopefully we'll get to catch up with you in the very near future when we hear more great things from you.
Thank you.
Take care.